Thank you all for coming, and thank you very much, Katja, for the invitation. It's really a pleasure to be here. I've never been here, even though I'm German. So what a lovely place you have a chance to live in. So it's really delightful. Usually Americans start with a joke. I'm really bad at that, so I'm just going straight forward with my presentation. Sorry about that. All right. So in Japan, as you probably all know, the last 40 years have seen major transformations in society, among them, of course, significant changes in Japanese families. But even though we've seen a beginning pluralization of partner relationships and life course models, marriage is still very much the ubiquitous choice of partner relationships. And in his 2010 book, Tachibanaki Toshiaki even calls Japan still a marrying society. Yet there are nonetheless many changes, of course, surrounding marriages. Among them, first and foremost, of course, the trend that Japanese couples marry less and later in life, which is seen as one of the major causes of Japan's fertility decline. A turn like demographic time bomb, namely the declining birth rate and the concurrent aging of society, is a prevalent topic, of course, in 21st century mass media as well as in academic research, but of course not just in Japan, many countries in Europe as well, Germany, Italy, and so on. I don't even know what the birth rate in Britain is, but sorry, failed to look that up. But it's also, of course, a significant focus among politicians, both in Japan and elsewhere, in their efforts for shoushika taisaku, so the political means to reverse the trend of the declining birth rate. So the strong link between marriage and fertility is due to the fact that the rate of extramarital births has remained rather low in Japan in comparison to other industrialized countries, but with rising rates of premarital sexuality. These have triggered, and many articles have been written on that. On the other hand, in the rate of dikichatakon, so, you know, marriages, the woman is already pregnant. So other changes are, of course, the increase in the divorce rate, increase in the rate of sexlessness among married couples, and lately a decrease also in marital fertility. But what has not much changed is that the continuous employment has remained very difficult for married women with children, as these are continuing structural difficulties for women to combine work, family, and marriage. And also continuing, if you look at Scott North's recent article in the Social Science Japan Journal, you know, it's a rather strict division of labor and marriage, husband's involvement in housework remaining low, so that has not that much changed yet. Standard constructions of academic discourse on marriage in Japan often assume that changes are initiated by women, and the declining marriage rate is pointing to that growing undesirability of marriage as well as the continuing structural difficulties for women to combine work, marriage, and having a family. The reasons underlying changed marriage patterns and attitudes towards marriage and childbearing, however, of course, defy monocausal explanations, and I think are yet to be fully explored. But at any rate, a common method to understand women's thoughts on marriage and motherhood, of course, you know, interviews, so ethnographic research, surveys, yet what, that's my argument, has been missing so far, is the analysis of female-oriented media, such as women's magazines. And here we come to the reason why I'm doing the study that I did. Women's magazines serve two functions. On the one hand, they serve as agents of socialization for their readership. And so as society changes, the messages of that society also change. And as we all know, media's role as agent of socialization still continues to grow. In 1995, Nancy Rosenberger wrote the following: "Women's magazines have some power over the way women categorize themselves, their wishes for self-actualization and relationship. The magazines establish a discourse of ideas and practices that presents an alternative to the discourses of ideas and practices presented to young women by dominant institutions such as family, school, and work. On the other hand, women's magazines can also be understood as so-called biography generators. So what are they? They are socially institutionalized devices that generate special kinds of discourse where the main topic is the biography of at least one of the participants. The theme of these discourses is a narrative form of identity. In other words, the self as a tale told. So really forms of culturally established self-disclosure. A while back, I did interviews with about a dozen Japanese women between the ages of 22 and 50, and contrasted the results of those, and I talked with them about their reading or not reading of magazines, women's magazines, and I'm not quite sure if you're familiar, there's a Dutch study quite well known by Joke Hermes on reading women's magazines, and she looked at Dutch readers, women, and reading women's magazines. And what I found is that for the Japanese women, excuse me, reading the magazines is not mostly a way of killing or passing time or filling empty time slots, which was the result in the Dutch study, but rather the content is much more important to the Japanese readers. Women's magazines also were shown to serve, from what I got in the interviews, to serve as a way of starting a conversation, particularly on very private topics such as sexuality, and thus have an important and more complex role in the lives of Japanese women, so it seems. So one woman was saying, well, I'd like to talk about, you know, sex with my girlfriends, but it's so, you know, you can't just, you know, start on that topic. So it's great, you know, one of the magazines I also analyze has a lot of talk show special issues on sexuality. So if you get that magazine and you look it over with your girlfriends, then you can, based on, oh, well, you know, it's written in a magazine, so it's a fine topic on discussion, and then you can from there on discuss your personal lives as well. As agents of socialization, women's magazines construct norms and prescribe normative behavior. Due to the heterogeneity, as far as I see it, of the content in women's magazines, through the way the content is presented and how they're presented to the reader, so the text form, the readers become very differently socialized. There are these so-called how-to articles, or you have reports by celebrities or medical doctors, who then are also constructed as specialists and who give advice to the reader. On the other hand, you know, there's a social aspect, a socializing aspect of this so-called pseudo-peer group through the voices of like-minded women in the women's magazine who share their personal experiences with the readers just as friends or a peer group would do. So the degree of the impact of the function of women's magazines as agents of socialization very much depends on the age of the target group. So declining in age but not, or declining with the increase in age but not fully disappearing either. In Japan, but elsewhere as well, it's not common that people talk, as I just said, in face-to-face conversation about themselves, their lives, and their emotions. And that's why there's the need for these so-called biography generators to provide a place where one's narrative identity can be developed. And if you look today at all the personal blogs on the internet, that's also a place where you can develop your narrative identity. Women's magazines are so, you know, culturally established places for doing that. In the majority of the articles, women report about their own experiences and lives, and thus the focus of the articles is on them and their feelings. So no matter, you know, how much the article is constructed or maybe is not even real, you know, we don't know, you know, but it's read as real by the women. Or if we speak in Goffman's terms, these voices about these very private matters of relationships and marriages can also be seen as the presentation of, so, you know, the backstage selves, but in this very public front stage medium of women's magazines. And so what we see is a continuing growing saturation of media in all levels of social life. So in regards to the nature of that rather complex relationship between media content and society, I understand that relationship as oscillating between three functions. So one, it reflects, and of course that's a problematic term, but it reflects society and culture. It serves as mean of social control, and it influences somehow attitudes and behavior of people. The fact that the relationship between media and society is a rather messy one is probably one of the main factors why the relationship and media in itself has not been studied in larger numbers by sociologists, and unfortunately I think media sociology is still not one of the main pillars within sociology. But to sum it up, at any rate, I believe media can contribute to attitudinal changes on non-traditional behavior and aid in providing role models in an increasingly individualized world. Now, for my presentation today, I would like to ask how exactly marriage is constructed within public discourse, and in particular women's magazines. What role models are the readers presented with, and could these discourses possibly have had an influence on how and why families have transformed in recent decades? Is within the discourses marriage constructed as something to aspire to, an ideal, a necessity, a source of happiness or unhappiness or discord? And since we see, as I just mentioned, changes in regards to marriage pattern in Japan, do we also see changes within the women's magazines discourse? Briefly to my methodology. What I've done is I conducted a longitudinal analysis of the marriage discourse in women's magazines through a qualitative and quantitative content analysis of four women's magazines over the course of 30 years, from 1970 to 1999. I further chose to look at only five-year intervals in order to reduce the quantity of that data to a manageable size. Women's magazines are long, and so a lot of pages. So this data set allows me to compare the marriage-related messages of the magazines for several demographic cohorts. So the four magazines that I analyzed are An'an, Moa, Croissant, and Fujin Kodon. So they target very different age groups. An'an is targeting the youngest women, approximately 18 to 24, all the way then Fujin Kodon targeting women age 40 and higher. I coded the data for three aspects of marriages: marriage motivations, marital happiness, and marital discord, and more on that in a minute. By selecting that particular data set, that allows me to look at marriage discourses targeting women born in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, thus really covering three generations of women. So these women read different magazines at different stages in their lives. So, for example, readers born in the 1930s and 40s hypothetically read Fujin Kodon, but women in the 1960s, all hypothetically, of course, read An'an, and then they graduate on to Moore and then to Croissant in the 1990s. So what I'm talking about when I say motivations, marital happiness, and discord, let me briefly show you the categories I defined for each based on the material and discourse I found and their overall distribution in the data set. That's just a very basic quantitative distribution, but I think it's alone a testimony of the overall impressive heterogeneity in voices, opinions, and life courses presented within the women's magazine articles. So here you see the distribution of marriage motivations, and the categories were not prefabricated. They came developed out of the material that I found. And here you just see the basic distribution, not by distinguished by year or which magazine they were found in. You just got to believe me right now. It was predominantly a topic for younger readers. So more than three quarters of all entries are to be found in An-An and More combined, and they are most frequently within the 1990s. Not surprising. In Causson and Fujin Kōran, so both the magazines that target comparatively older women, 30 and up, motivations for marriage are discussed then much less. So whereas the discourse about marriage motivations is most frequent in the 1990s, the mentioning of not wanting to marry is the most frequent within the 1980s. That could potentially be interpreted as a motor function of magazine discourses, but more to that. Here just the summary. So the higher frequency of discussing no desire for marriage within the 1980s occurs at a time when overall both Moore and Causson were most influenced by the second wave of the Japanese feminist movement, a trend that got lost then in the magazines in the 1990s. Now, in regards to marital happiness, all four magazines have what I categorized as, and it's a very broad category, apologies, but good partner relationships, and independence as a second most frequent category. Yet both magazines for older women have a higher frequency of reporting extramarital affairs as a source of marital happiness. And I'll get to that in just a bit. Now, the distribution of discord categories. Compared to the discussion on motivations of marriage and marital happiness, discussion on marital problems are overall most frequent. So whereas in regards to motivations for marriage, it was overwhelmingly, as I just said, in the articles in An-An and More, and comparatively few in Causson and Fujin Kōran, now in regards to the discord in marriage, it's just the relationships just opposite. So discords are a much more important topic for comparatively older women, who are the target group of Causson and Fujin Kōran, who might actually themselves have years of marital experience. Readers of An-An and More most likely to have little or no experience with marriage, and thus rather that step to marriage is much more a focus of those magazines. And so, of course, that table, again, does not give you the discourses broken down by time, but, for example, financial problems, as you see here, have seen their largest share in the 1990s throughout all four magazines. So that underlines, as I see it, the economic downturn that Japan experienced in the post-bubble burst, and that continuously struggling economy since then. So those consequences kind of trickle down and are reflected in the increase in the quantity of that category in the women's magazines. So how I want to proceed from here is, that's just a basic summary of what I just said. But how I want to proceed from here is that I'm now explaining the discourses for each of the different age cohorts. But I'll explain the discourses for women born in the 1930s and 40s in greater detail, because I think that's the most interesting findings that I have there too. But just briefly summarize the main findings for the subsequent age cohorts for contrast, and in order to show you the most significant changes and differences among them. All right, so the generation of women born in the 1930s and 40s have seen, again, significant changes in society during their formative years. They were born in wartime Japan, raised by pre-war parents, yet experienced their youth in the immediate post-war and lived through the occupation period, the creation of a new constitution of Japan, and unprecedented new legal rights for women. In the 1960s then, the women were in their 1920s and 30s during the beginning of Japan's economic boom period, the time of the dissemination of the salaryman ideal and what Ochiai Emiko has termed the post-war turn towards the home, and the increase in full-time homemaking. During the 1970s then, when the second women's movement was taking hold, these women now are in their 30s and 40s. And I'm analyzing here what these women, of course, hypothetically read in the 1970s and 80s, which would have been then Fujin Kōran at the time. Let me begin with an overall evaluation, namely that this discourse I find is quite progressive, and which I eventually would term somehow, in quotes, ahead. I base that evaluation on the following findings. All right. As mentioned before, motivations for marriage overall are rarely mentioned in Fujinkuna. In the 1970s, equally missing is an explicit voice, though, against marriage. Yet then, by the 1980s, we find some, such as one from the October 1980 issue. Here, writer Anzai Atsuko discusses and criticizes the law that women have to change their last names to those of their husbands. She describes how complicated that law has made her own life. She begins with explaining that she had gotten pregnant in 1946, not married yet, so in response to which they registered her and her baby's father's koseki, his family's family registry for marriage, an act to which she also had to take, of course, up his family name. She is of the opinion that it is odd and really problematic to sort of, how she says, move out of one's own family and move into that of the husband's through that very act. She further mentions that she just read a book about slavery, and she now considers the name change requirement a form of slavery. Well, she ends up eventually divorcing her husband and remarries, which meant that a name change process that really turned weird and which she greatly opposes. Because as a consequence of the divorce, she returned back to her maiden name, only to lose it again to her new husband's family name at the time of remarriage. So overall, this article is really a rather outspoken commentary on the persistent gender inequality surrounding marriage and the marriage name thing in Japan. And since this law on fufubese, as you all know, still has not changed and still is a topic of public debate in politics, and if you remember in 2010, when politician Noda Seiko got pregnant and she wasn't married, and her outspokenness against the law, and that was, you know, 30 years later, I think that certainly points somehow to Fujinkuran's progressiveness at the time. Well, most of you, all of you are familiar with the supposedly widespread desire of women for their spouse to have sanko. So the three highs, you know, high education, high income, and high or tall body, which became highly popular for younger women in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and how clearly, of course, a middle-class ideal. This marriage motivation in Fujinkuran, which within the 1970s and 80s discourse, of course, is absent. What we find instead is the desire for security as an expression of a kind of lower class motivation for marriage, even though the magazine itself is not specifically targeting lower class women. So women who get a voice in Fujinkuran during these two decades often mention financial fears and hardships. They intend to see marriage as a rescue from their fate and poverty. Usually these women have grown up in single mother families and not, you know, the ones that Katya studied. Now, in those cases, it's the father having died rather early on. But these stories are usually linked with these women reporting about their employment, which in their case, of course, is not a freed choice or a sign of independence and liberation, but rather a dear necessity. So let me just give you one example. In the Fujinkuran issue from February 1980, 26-year-old Yoshida Sachiko from Akita-ken tells her story and also the story of her mother. In both instances, it shows that the motivation for marriage was to escape poverty. But at the end of marriage, be it through divorce or widowhood, and in her case it was divorce, in her mother's case widowhood, further throws women in poverty and highlights the deficiencies of the social welfare system to protect these women. At the time of writing, Sachiko is separated from her husband, has filed for divorce with the family court, and is now living with her mother and disabled older brother. Her husband, whom she had married to get away from her impoverished life, ran off after less than a year of marriage. Sachiko's mother, on the other hand, had married Sachiko's father in arranged marriage. The father then, however, turned out to be an alcoholic, and after several years of illness, passed away at the age of 35, when her mother was only 32 years old. Sachiko 6 and her older brother 10. So at the time of writing, Sachiko cares for her disabled brother while her mother continues earning the money for the three of them by working, she writes, extremely hard as a factory worker. All right. So granted, a desire not to marry is rarely discussed in the discourse for this generation of women born in the 1930s and 40s. But where it is mentioned, I once again find these articles what I would term progressive. For example, in June 1980, one of the articles features a discussion between Oba Minako and writer and psychiatry professor Kaga Otohiko, where they discuss women, love, and independence, rather long article. Oba and Kaga agree that love does not have much to do with marriage. One of the dangers they warn their readers about is for wives to fully commit their lives to their husbands and children. Because once they are less needed, like when the children advance to middle school, the wives risk developing neuroses and becoming unhappy. And furthermore, Kaga expresses his opinion that it is not good to completely separate work and life and thus have husbands and wives lead completely separate lives. He says that whereas in Japan, husbands are said to never speak about their work with their wives, in the U.S. supposedly, wives know everything about their spouse's employment. And another point that I'll be making later, we find this idealization of the West in numerous instances, also the idealization of the Western man, Western partnerships, and I'll get to that in just a bit. And Oba is of the opinion that particularly financial independence through employment can be seen as empowering a wife and is a very positive aspect. And Oba also believes that that can raise the wife's level of happiness. Other articles, for example, explicitly mention that divorce becomes a great deal less of a scary option if the wife has financial independence by maintaining full-time employment throughout the marriage and even the child-raising period. Well, as you saw on that table before, that category that I called a good relationship was the most important happiness indicator. Yet this can have, as I said before, diverse meanings, such as, and under that falls, having cute and healthy children, having fun in the marriage, having a good sex life, having good communication between the partners, absence of extramarital affairs of the husband, love, and the equality between the partners in regards to the share of household and children. The equality between the partners in regards to the share, even though this is one of many, but an important aspect within that construction of what is a good partnership, that's certainly an aspect that even in 2012 has remained an important topic of discussion in public discourse as well as, of course, in the women's magazines. For this, let me give you another example, an article written by writer and 1952 Naoki Shou Literary Award winner Saotome Katsumoto in the December 1975 issue of Fujinkura. So Saotome is working from home, whereas his wife works outside, and they have three children. His wife has been working as an elementary school teacher for 13 years. Their children all wear daycare, and so that she could keep working throughout the time also that the children were young. Now, two of the children have advanced to elementary school, and one is still in daycare. The husband, as I mentioned, is an author, and he works from home. And that describes that he's much more flexible in the way he can distribute his time, so he can help much more in terms of childcare and household issues. He further states that both partners have achieved a level of independence that is important to them, and they both have their own, as he says, place, which aids in the relationship to be happy. The article shows that often several happiness indicators go hand in hand. So, as I said, the combination of the wife's employment together with the husband who shares in household and childcare duties, and both partners therefore having achieved a sense of independence for themselves within the marriage are important factors contributing to that couple considering themselves happy. So this and other articles point to the argument that equality and sharing duties regarding household and childcare issues brings happiness, whereas no equality adds to frustration and complaints. Messages that are transferred through the articles are that equality in household duties is most likely to be achieved among couples where both partners are employed, which intertwines these aspects closely, but it can also be achieved through husbands taking on the still unconventional role of house husband. And here, let me just give you a brief visualization of images of idealized house husband. On the left there, you see an article on the Swedish husband taking a year of childcare leave. And that's from Fudinkona and also from 1975. And on the right side, you see two illustrations from an article from Cosson from 1980. There in the middle, he waves her goodbye when she goes off to work. And down below, on, all the way on the right, he serves mother and child the dinner when they're back home. All right. Well, so to continue with the elements in the discourses for readers from the 1940s, we find also a quantitative in. You get to see that a little bit later. Okay, I did a mistake there. Okay, whatever. Okay, so. And the reporting of extramarital, let's go back then, extramarital affairs in Fujinkoda. In the 1970s, husbands are the only ones reported as having extramarital affairs. Yeah, that changes in the 1980s, when a significant part of the articles describe the wives as being the ones straying from the marriage and having extramarital affairs. So whereas in the 1970s, infidelity was more so a source of discord, as wives suffered under the husband's affairs, in the 1980s, women report their own affairs and judge them as positive and as sources of happiness. So it's not the relationship to the spouse, but rather the affair that is the source of happiness, which does not really speak much for those marriages as such, but is a rather sobering view, of course, of on Japanese marriages, with the affair serving sort of as an escape from unhappiness. One can understand the shift in discourse is putting women into a more active role. They're over time less so passive victims suffering from their husband's extramarital affairs, but rather actively searching out extramarital relationships themselves if they consider a marriage somehow lacking or are somehow dissatisfied with the sex life with their husbands. What these stories and articles show is a very active way of women sort of curing their marital unhappiness. Yet, of course, this chosen way is not a solution of structural change or change on any form of macro level. The women use the power they have is on a very personal scale. They are not accepting their unhappy marriages, yet many of them do not feel they have enough power to flee through a divorce. Many articles are on that topic. Yet what they do have is the power of engaging in extramarital affairs. So that reminds us of the tactics of the weapons of the weak in Ogasawara's work in regards to the relationship between salarymen and office ladies. Now, you can barely see that. Okay, next point is pro-divorce. In the 1970s and 80s, the magazine discourse is overall outspokenly pro-divorce, even though often stating the difficulties of getting a divorce or the hard life post-divorce, but which is nonetheless evaluated as better than the marriage itself. Divorce specialist Maruka Yoriko, who is now turned politician, is one of the people who get a voice quite frequently, and not just during these two decades in Fujinkoran, but also in later decades, and actually in all of the magazines that I analyzed. She's outspokenly pro-choice on the issue of divorce, and she passionately writes against the excuse that a woman cannot divorce because she supposedly cannot feed herself or her children. Maruka says that this excuse cannot be accepted, as she thinks there is work, that society is changing, so that there is no real reason anymore to delay divorce. Now we're coming to the bothersome parents-in-law. No, we can't. I'll show you that picture. We know already, of course, from several academic studies that the hardships of daughters-in-law with their parents-in-law, in particular, mothers-in-law, are how tough they are. Well, descriptions of the difficulties with parents-in-law is unique to the discourse within Fujinkōdan. None of the other ones discuss that, and also in Fujinkōdan, it's declining over time. This decline could be explained in part by the growing nuclearization of Japanese families. So the decreasing situation of multi-generation families having to live under one roof. The problem, as described in Fujinkōdan, falls into three main categories of difficulties. Namely, one, the parental opposition to marriage to a particular partner in the first place. Two, the difficulties faced by a couple, and mostly the wife, in living together with the parents-in-law on a daily basis. And the amaya relationship between mother and son, which the young wives then suffer from. So in regards to the parental opposition to the marriage, opposition can have many different reasons, such as racial issues, age-related issues, financial or educational gaps between the partners. For all of these, you find several articles. But the example I want to give you is from an article in February 1975 in Fujinkōdan, which describes the woman's parents' opposition to her relationship with a Japanese man, but whose father happens to be Korean. She's 23 years old, and her boyfriend is a colleague from work. For her, the fact that her boyfriend's deceased, was Korean and had not been an issue, and she had never given the fact that her boyfriend, therefore, is part non-Japanese a second thought. But for a parent, this is the reason why they do not agree with the marriage. In the article, the woman tries to contemplate that meaning of race. She talks about black, white, yellow, as she labels it, and also on stratification, rich versus poor. But as she writes, if you further add the distinction of someone's father being Korean, she sees this as an example of discrimination, and once again, a rather outspoken article. The opposition of her parents was so strong that she had to listen to her complaints, to their complaints on a daily basis. She was close to giving up her partner because the pressure on her had been so much. But she did feel that she could not break up her relationship. But what instead she did was to quit her workplace. And at the time of writing, the article remains unemployed, but nonetheless continues seeing her boyfriend in secret. She contemplates on the meaning of parents, bloodline, marriage, and having children. She's together at the time of writing with her boyfriends for 3 years and mentions that her friends have mostly married now, they're housewives and are busy with child rearing. And, you know, this is 1975 and she's age 23. She looks at that with envy and wants that for herself as well. She says she would be so happy if she would marry him, but also probably the saddest, as she would most certainly lose her family over that dispute, as she assumes. So the difficult task of weighing her own happiness versus the guilt that would come with running away from home, getting married, and by that also ruining her younger sister's marriage chances, because her own marriage with a part Korean man would stain sort of the whole family reputation. At the time of writing the article, she's still undecided of how she should handle this situation, if being selfish for her own happiness or being selfless for the sake of her family standing in society. So I think this is also a great example or a great illustration of a woman struggling with the very confining societal norms, racial issues within Japan, and then, of course, the importance still of family in marriage issues. And now, all right, now we get to Kshabi. So abortion, for example, was not discussed at all within the articles of the data set in the 1970s, but then gained visibility in the 1980s. Rather than interpreting this rise in discourse as a reflection of the rise in the rate of abortion, it probably is more so the case that that's an expression of liberation of women in greater numbers in the 1980s, feeling freer and emancipated enough to discuss abortion in this mass medium, and of course, you know, editors feeling that that's now a topic you can write upon. Yet the stories themselves are just the opposite from liberation. They rather tell stories of extreme submissiveness to the husband's desires, resulting in severe emotional and physical strain on the side of the wives. The same is true in regards to the complaints by wives about the husband's not using contraception, for example. And in one case, it results in the wife constantly fearing of getting pregnant, even if not resulting in an actual pregnancy or abortion. She's not actually allowed to have more children because she's rather sick and she's told not to have any, but he's not using contraception. So the fear alone is hard enough on the woman and reason for serious marital dissatisfaction. So much for the marriage discourse on for women born in the 1930s and 40s. Now, just briefly, for the age cohort of women born in the 1950s and 60s. So these women grew up at the height of the students' movement at the end of the 1960s and the women's movement, which then began in 1970. When the delay in marriages and the drop in fertility rate became visible in statistics since the middle the 1970s, these women then are in their teens and 20s. Their adolescence is, however, also very much still a time in which white-collar corporate culture continues going strong. And the women also grew up during a time of spectacular growth of the economy. But when the bubble economy eventually burst in 1989, these women are in their 20s and 30s. After that, Japan, of course, as you know, is said to have entered the lost decade, a time signified in particular through the high growth of temporary workers and theta, forms of unstable employment, and a far cry from the lifelong employment so ferociously imagined to be the form of employment of middle-class Japan. So the shift in role models also further exemplifies the drastic changes that women born in the 1950s and 60s went through. So you probably know the role model of the 1970s was Yamaguchi Momoi, born in 1959, singer and actress, who already in 1980, at the age of 21, and the height of her career, got married, quit her career, and became a full-time housewife. Then the role model of the 1980s became Matsuda Seiko, just born a few years later in 1962, who, even though also married young, continued her career through marriage and motherhood, and in later years had a widely publicized divorce and affair with an American man, and so on and so on. Now, the discourse for the age cohort of women born in the 1950s, the main findings can be summarized as the following. So we find, for one, a high frequency in the 1980s on women reporting no motivation to marry, and also a growing pluralization of relationship models, greater plurality than if you look at the American or English language academic writing of that time, then it's rather surprising that plurality we find in the women's magazines discourses. We also find women reporting marrying at a very early as well as a very late age. So very non-standard and non-traditional marriage patterns. So we find reports of marriages of women that still marry during their student times, but then also first marriages of women in their 40s and 50s, and childbirth when they're in their late 30s. And several articles focus on generational change in terms of attitudes. So in one such article, the age ranges of women who are given a voice ranges from age 22 to 49, and the oldest woman, born in 1931, is then 49 years old at the time of the article, and her concern about and favor for marriage is purely of a practical nature, being concerned about the socially fragile standing of unmarried women. She suggests that it is better to marry because unmarried women are not rich and not physically and psychologically secure. She gives an interesting illustration of this by saying that, and here I quote, because a woman's range in society is small, if the man doesn't provide the stage, the woman can't sing. I didn't find that practical nature anymore in marriage motivations stated by women in later decades. In the 1980s, Croissant actually happens to be quite feminist-leaning, and we find several translations of articles by Simone de Beauvoir, articles from Ms. magazine, but with a time lag of 8 years. So articles that were published in the U.S. in 1972 were published in Croissant in 1980. So you see the delay of the feminist wave hitting Japan. And we also find continuities to the discourse of Fujinkōdan for the women born in the two decades before. One of the continuing is the discussion of the parental opposition to marriage. So we still have that. The perseverance to survive as couple, despite the parental opposition, is seen as a factor for why the marriages then are such happy ones. Namely, because the couple already went through hardship together before they even got to the stage of being married. And interesting in this context is the absence of the possibility or even considering getting married without parental approval. So marriage at that time can still very much be seen as a family affair beyond just the couple themselves. Now, in the discourse, in the discourse for women born in the 1960s, when readers hypothetically graduate from reading very liberal Moore magazine to Croissant then in the 1990s, which at that time, you know, as just said, 1980s was very feminist tendencies, and now all of a sudden in the 1990s the magazine had turned quite housewifey and quite conservative. So we find a major break in the discourse for this group of hypothetical readers. The break, for example, can be seen in the significant decline from a high frequency of women having no motivation to marry to this line of discourse becoming absolutely insignificant in the 1990s. And in An-An, then, in the 1980s, we find rather conservative desires for traditional gender roles, the male breadwinner, the fulfillment of the three highs, which I mentioned earlier, and romantic, very romantic visions of marriage, to become happy through marriage. But then when the readers graduate to Moore in the 1990s, we find that discourse sort of splits between the more conservative gender roles and idealizing the housewife versus then on the other side, the desire for particular financial independence and continuous employment, which becomes then in the 1990s a very important topic in Moore. So for these women born in the 1960s, the women's magazines discourses that they are exposed to are highly diverse and are, as far as I see, very much mixed messages, but overall, presenting less of a progressive gist than the discourses for women in the earlier decades. Now, just briefly to the discourse for women born in the 1970s and 80s. So that hypothetical group of readers. These women have joined the labor market after the Equal Employment Opportunity Law in 1986 was put into place, and they have enjoyed the possibility of careers in greater numbers than the generations before them. Their generation to have the most liberty to choose between work and marriage. Yet at the same time, these women are also the group said to agonize the most over this decision, work or marriage, and particularly the decision for children. The women are said to want it all, but because combining it, career and babies is still very much, even today, a difficult option that is still not as frequently chosen in Japan as in other places, they eventually just end up significantly delaying childbirth. And, you're probably all well aware of it, the public attention of arafo, so women around 40, is the word of the year, I think, a few years ago. So it's interesting to see what messages these women were exposed to when they were growing up in their early to late 20s. So within the marriage discourse for this group of women, the most important feature is that overall the heterogeneity in marriage possibilities, which we already saw for the earlier generation of women, continues and is further elevated. By now, marriage has become only one of many life course options within the magazine. And just to illustrate that, my point here, you see, I took illustrations from Anan, here from 1995 and 1999, I think exemplifying a multitude of different options without, in the article, without any judgment or ranking of one option being better than the other. So you have here on top the weekend relationship. You have the house husband, or, you know, he is doing all the cooking. You have the long distance relationship, which is, you know, contact me usually through email. And in the middle, you have the boyfriend, husband, whatever, partner, who is doing the, you know, as you see symbolized here by the rice, you know, who's doing the cooking, who's doing the childcare. But then all the way on the bottom right, you have the working mother who is dropping off the child with her parents. So really the focus is on anything goes, and a very limited concern over the, in the articles now, over social norms regarding partnership patterns, and very much a trend towards individualization of life courses. Now, let me come to my conclusion. I hope to have been able to make the following points in my presentation. One is that certain ideas or complaints about marriages were much earlier discussed in the women's magazines than were statistically measurable, so we're sort of ahead of their time. Even though there's no linear development, whereas in the women's magazines discourses. We see in the 1970s and early 1980s, in particular for the women born in the 1930s and 40s, significant progressiveness and particularly quite explicit feminist tendencies. That advance, however, kind of gets smaller if you can't even measure it that way. But let's say it's a development from sort of a half step ahead to, you know, being in line with, you know, what we also do from academic findings today. Other point is that there's overall significant complexity and heterogeneity within the marriage discourses in my select women's magazines. Women are described as having agency within their lives in regards to their relationships. But it should be kept in mind that women's magazines lack greatly in seeing social structural aspects, and that's what they're mostly criticized for anyway. In the majority of articles, women's magazines stay in their descriptions or analysis on a very personal level. They mostly don't see beyond the micro level towards the macro level. Women's magazines often have been criticized for not letting their female readers see the structural constraints they're surrounded with. So what they offer is mostly solutions to whatever problems on a very personal micro level. They don't call for activism in some form of social movement group trying to take those larger issues at hand, but rather try to provide the female readers with a very personal solution within the boundaries of that system. Maybe stretching it a little bit here and there on that personal individual level, but otherwise keeping the system intact. But to conclude, let me also elaborate what I mentioned just briefly before, two further findings, which are, I believe, also highly important if you want to understand the media messages on marriages for women during those 30 years. And those findings span the discourses for all cohorts of hypothetical readers. Just briefly, so one is the idealization of the West, and the other is the importance of the role of celebrities in marriage discourses. So the idealization of the West and the dichotomization of Japan versus the West remains constant over the 30 years of analysis. In this discourse, the West is constructed as a place of free, unconventional, and equal partner relationships. And these Western partner relationships are often constructed in contrast to problematic Japanese partner relationships. Particularly Western men are positively constructed as being physically superior, their open way of showing love and affection, and their gentleman behavior. So the articles really construct collective identities of Japan and the West. On the left here, you see, of course, the Swedish husband, the house husband, as I showed you before. This is an article on European husbands on the weekends. Not a very flattering image, but the article is telling, you know, Japanese husbands, rather stereotypical, are just, you know, sleeping and going golfing on the weekend. But European husbands are doing gardening. That's kind of the one with the chicken here. and they're going grocery shopping, and they're playing with the children. Anyway, they are available for the family. And this is an article in War, 1995, on French Paris, Paris couples, and particularly points out cohabitation. These are all couples, several couples. I mean, it's a long, long article. Of cohabitating, they're not married, but some of them even already have children, and they are elevated sort of to celebrity status. And now you can even see, you know, how they live, you know, I mean, how they furnish their apartments, and also described as very positive and cool. And a few more here on just showing affection in public is also something you don't necessarily see that much in Japan. And here she says, oh, I love you, I love you, I love you. And he says, let's talk. I love you, I love you, I love you. And signifying, you know, how expressive in emotional things Western men are. And from that same article, he says, I'm your knight. So very much a gentleman behavior. All right. So, and the last one is... sorry, I didn't put any images on that one. But within the discourses in many of the articles, it is celebrities, which could be anyone from actresses, models, as I quoted before, literary authors, who get a voice in the articles, next to, of course, numerous everyday women. As a whole, the voices of the celebrities seem to be sort of above society in a way that normal rules and norms are not necessarily applicable to them. They often have quite liberal ideas of marriage, so marrying late, not marrying at all, having divorces, combining marriage and work. Thus are often used in articles on marriage and relationships as role models for kind of alternative ways of living in a relationship. So one could argue that just as fashion trends are said to trickle down from the upper classes to the lower, as Veblen described in regards to fashion and taste, so it might actually be with the lifestyles of celebrities. And of course, that's not just a trend in Japan. It's a global trend, and I really enjoy Gabler's study on this, the ubiquity of celebrities in our everyday lives, that we feel closer to Diana, or we, you know, the description of people having cried more at the news of Diana's death than of the news of their next door neighbor having died. Right? So now, as you noticed, my analysis only goes of women's magazines between 1970 and 1999. So naturally, your question probably is, what about marriage discourses today? What has changed? What hasn't? My apologies, I have not done such a systematic study for the last 10, 12 years. I did stop in 1999, but I do have kept abreast with reading them. So this is just a brief illustration on this. And it's not fully figured out, but here's my little two words on that one. So I'm contrasting here a survey that was done among in 1985 in Annan among recently married women with an average age of 24 on the left. On the right, you see a survey that was conducted and presented in an issue in 2008, a survey among over 1,000 unmarried women with an average age of approximately 27. So not really comparable, but that's as best as I could right now. On the left hand, they are stating their reasons why they recently have gotten married. On the right side, you see, you know, why they would want to marry now. You see three similar reasons.
I want to be with this man, so, you know, it's really love, you know, that needs to be that particular one. I just then wanted children, now has become top priority. This one was not ranked, so again, not really great comparison, but just to give you a little hunch. And I don't want to live alone anymore versus being alone is lonely in 26% of the cases. What I couldn't find on this one is women who said, well, marriage itself, doesn't matter to who, but marriage itself was my ideal. Next one was, I want to become independent from family. Didn't find that one later. And Dikchatakon, I had gotten pregnant. Want to be economically secure is a reason mentioned in 2008. Fear about the future was also. What I found surprising is that still 13% said to fulfill my parents' expectations. But of course, these are women now at age 27, so maybe pressure has increased. I don't know. And I don't want to work. So marriage, again, as this is the way I finally can become a housewife and quit my job. Okay, so just briefly on that. Marriage Tokshu in Anan. So, you know, the way Anan operates, and it's different to other magazines, is they have one special topic, and then numerous articles fall onto that. And here, just an illustration, anything from 1992 to 2008. And so marriage is still very much a topic out there being discussed, but rather diverse. But so, but is it late marriage? Is it early marriage? You know, should one marry when one is pregnant? These are topics still out there and to be analyzed, hopefully at some point in the future. Interesting here in 2007, when on the left side, when you see here, how do I find a happy future? Well, listed as number one is love, listed at number two is work, and only number three is marriage. And then in 2008, you see, you know, 仕事が幸せ, so work as my happiness. So, you know, again, lots of mixed marriage, mixed messages, but work definitely is quite important. And I thought this was cool. This was still from my data from 1999, and this is the Love Body campaign. I don't know if you know the Takano Yuri Beauty Clinic, very popular. This was their campaign in 1995. This is Matsuda Seiko, your role model from the 1980s. White dress, very, very much dressed. 4 years later, you have Kanda Uno, naked. And, you know, Anan anyway is very known for having rather revolutionary cover pages. One was even in 1995 or so, was even prohibited, was taken off the market because it was a naked model, and there was a little bit of water on the ground, and you could maybe see her genitals reflected in the water, and whatever. But it was taken off the market. It was a pretty big scandal. So they are known for nudity on their covers. And but this is, you know, the Love Body cut here. It's really a hidden advertorial because eventually when you go through the article, it's really just a large advertorial for that particular beauty clinic. Because she went, you know, she dieted and had all these great beauty things done with her. And now this was is from November of last year, and now she's pregnant. And actually pregnancy has become now, I found that now in several of Anand's issues. And, you know, that's just my hunch right now with the very low fertility. You know, that's a new, is that now a topic that we're trying to promote women to have more children? I don't know, but it's just an interesting illustration. And this is now the last, also a pregnant woman, Obuchi Yuko, the former minister of low fertility rate, family minister. And now here, she's really combining marriage, motherhood,
course, being really rich and being from a politician's family and career, plus being fashionable and sexy, being a hot mama. So I'll leave you with that. And so anyway, I do hope I have shown that the analysis of mass media discourse can aid, slightly at least, in our understanding of what's going on in Japanese society in regards to marriage, ideas of partnerships, divorce, motherhood, and subsequently the reasons why Japanese women forgo marriage and motherhood in increasing numbers. And Japanese women still, the circulation numbers are still very high in Japanese women's magazines, so somehow these messages are circulated and are out there. So thank you.